Melissa, a blonde in her early 30s, was at the same time an elf and a succubus. Her green eyes were large and guileless, yet simultaneously smoky, mysterious. Her nose was pert, but her mouth was sensuous, the essence of all erotic orifices. She had large breasts, a slim waist, and long legs, but she chose to conceal those attributes in loose white blouses, white lab coats, and baggy chinos. In her scuffed Nikes, her feet were no doubt so feminine and delicate that Roy would have been delighted to spend hours kissing them. He had never made a pass at her because she was reserved and businesslike, and because he suspected that she was a lesbian. He had nothing against lesbians, live and let live. At the same time, however, he was loath to reveal his interest only to be rejected. Melissa said crisply, "Good morning, Roy. How have you been? Good heavens, you know, I haven't been in L.A., haven't seen you since..." "I was just examining the file." Straight to business. She was never interested in small talk. "We have a finished enhancement." When Melissa was talking, Roy was never able to decide whether to look at her eyes or her mouth. Her gaze was direct with a challenge that he found appealing, but her lips were so deliciously ripe. She pushed a photograph across the desk. Roy looked away from her lips. The picture was a drastically improved full-color version of the shot that he had seen on his attaché case computer terminal the night before, a man's head from the neck up in profile. Shadows still dappled the face, but they were lighter and less obscuring than they had been. The blurring screen of rain had been removed entirely. "It's a fine piece of work," Roy said, "but it still doesn't give us a good enough look at him to make an identification."
"On the contrary, it tells us a lot about him," Melissa said. "He's between 28 and 32.
"How do you figure?"
"Computer projection based on an analysis of lines radiating from the corner of his eye, percentage of gray in his hair, and the apparent degree of firmness of facial muscles and throat skin."
"Now that's projecting quite a lot from such a few..."
"Not at all," she interrupted. "The system makes analytic projections operating from a 10-megabyte database of biological information, and I'd pretty much bet the house on what it says."
He was thrilled by the way her supple lips formed the words, 10-megabyte database of biological information. Her mouth was better than her eyes. Perfect. He cleared his throat. "Well..."
"Brown hair, brown eyes."
Roy frowned. "The hair, okay, but you can't see his eyes here."
Rising from her chair, Melissa took the photograph out of his hand and put it on the desk. With a pencil, she pointed to the beginning curve of the man's eyeball as viewed from the side. "He's not looking at the camera, so if you or I examine the photo under a microscope, we still wouldn't be able to see enough of the iris to determine color. But even from an oblique perspective like this, the computer can detect a few pixels of color."
"So he has brown eyes?"
"Dark brown."
She put down the pencil and stood with her left hand fisted on her hip, as delicate as a flower and as resolute as an army general.
"Absolutely dark brown."
Roy liked her unshakable self-confidence, the brisk certitude with which she spoke, and that mouth.
"Based on the computer's analysis of his physical relationship to measurable objects in the photograph, he's 5 feet 11 inches tall."
She clipped her words so the facts came out of her with the staccato energy of bullets from a submachine gun.
"He weighs 165, give or take 5 pounds. He's Caucasian, clean-shaven, in good physical shape, recently had a haircut."
"Anything else?"
From the file folder, Melissa removed another photograph. "This is him, from the front, straight on, his full face."
Roy looked up from the new photo, surprised. "I didn't know we got a shot like this."
"We didn't," she said, studying the portrait with evident pride. "This isn't an actual photograph. It's a projection of what the guy ought to look like, based on what the computer can determine of his bone structure and fat deposit patterns from the partial profile."
"It can do that?"
"It's a recent innovation in the program."
"Reliable?"
"Considering the view the computer had to work with in this case," she assured Roy, "there's a 94% probability that this face will precisely match the real face in any 90 of 100 reference details."
"I guess that's better than a police artist's sketch," he said.
"Much better."
After a beat, she said,
"Is something wrong?"
Roy realized that she had shifted her gaze from the computer portrait to him, and that he was staring at her mouth.
He said, looking down at the full portrait of the mystery man.
I was wondering, what's this line across his right cheek?
A scar.
Really? You're sure? From the ear to the point of the chin?
A major scar, she said, opening a desk drawer. Cicatricial welt, mostly smooth tissue, crimped here and there along the edges.
Roy referred to the original profile shot and saw that a portion of the scar was there, although he had not correctly identified it. I thought it was just a line of light between shadows, light from the street lamp falling across his cheek.
No.
It couldn't be that?
No, a scar,
Melissa said firmly, and she took a Kleenex from a box in the open drawer. This is great. Makes for an easier ID. This guy seems to have had special forces training, either military or paramilitary, and with a scar like this, it's a good bet he was wounded while on duty, badly wounded, maybe badly enough that he was discharged or retired on psychological, if not physical, disability.
Police and military organizations keep records forever.
Exactly. We'll have him in 72 hours. Hell, 48.
Roy looked up from the portrait.
Thanks, Melissa. She was wiping her mouth with the Kleenex. She didn't have to be concerned about smearing her lipstick because she wasn't wearing any. She didn't need lipstick. It couldn't improve her. Roy was fascinated by the way in which her full and pliant lips compressed so tenderly under the soft Kleenex. He realized that he was staring and that again she was aware of it. His gaze drifted up to her eyes. Melissa blushed faintly, looked away from him, and threw the crumpled Kleenex in the waste can. "May I keep this copy?" he asked, indicating the full-face computer-generated portrait. Withdrawing a manila envelope from beneath the file folder on the desk, handing it to him, she said,
"I put 5 prints in here plus 2 diskettes that contain the portrait."
"Thanks, Melissa."
"Sure."
The warm pink blush was still on her cheeks. Roy felt that he had penetrated her cool, businesslike veneer for the first time since he'd known her, and that he was in touch, however tenuously, with the inner Melissa, with the exquisitely sensuous self that she usually strove to conceal. He wondered if he should ask her for a date. Turning his head, he looked through the glass walls at the workers in the computer lab, certain that they must be aware of the erotic tension in their boss's office. All 3 seemed to be absorbed in their work. When Roy turned to Melissa Wicklund again, prepared to ask her to dinner, she was surreptitiously wiping at one corner of her mouth with a fingertip. She tried to cover by spreading her hand across her mouth and faking a cough. With dismay, Roy realized that the woman had misinterpreted his salacious stare. Apparently, she thought that his attention had been drawn to her mouth by a smear or crumb of food left over, perhaps, from a mid-morning donut. She had been oblivious of his lust. If she was a lesbian, she must have assumed that Roy knew as much and would have no interest in her. If she wasn't a lesbian, perhaps she simply couldn't imagine being attracted or being an object of desire to a man with round cheeks, a soft chin, and 10 extra pounds on his waist. He had met with that prejudice before. Looksism. Many women brainwashed by a consumer culture that sold the wrong values were interested only in men like those who appeared in advertisements for Marlboro or Calvin Klein. They could not understand that a man with the merry face of a favored uncle might be kinder, wiser, more compassionate, and a better lover than a hunk who spent too much time at the gym. How sad to think that Melissa might be that shallow. How very sad.
"Can I help you with anything else?" she asked.
"No, this is fine. This is a lot. We'll nail him with this."
She nodded.
"I have to get down to the print lab, see if they've got anything off that flashlight or bathroom window."
"Yes, of course," she said awkwardly.
He indulged in one last look at her perfect mouth, sighed, and said, "See you later." After he had stepped out of her office, closed the door behind him, and crossed 2/3 of the long computer lab, he looked back, half hoping that she would be staring wistfully after him. Instead, she was sitting at her desk again, holding a compact in one hand, examining her mouth in that small mirror. China Dream was a West Hollywood restaurant in a quaint 3-story brick building in an area of trendy shops. Spencer parked a block away, left Rocky in the truck again, and walked back. The air was pleasantly warm. The breeze was refreshing. It was one of those days when the struggles of life seemed worth waging. The restaurant was not yet open for lunch. Nevertheless, the door was unlocked, and he went inside. The China Dream indulged in none of the decor common to many Chinese restaurants. No dragons or foo dogs, no brass ideograms on the walls. It was starkly modern, pearl gray and black, with white linen on the 30 or 40 tables. The only Chinese art object was a life-sized carved wood statue of a gentle-faced robed woman holding what appeared to be an inverted bottle or a gourd. It was standing just inside the door. Two Asian men in their 20s were arranging flatware and wine glasses. A third man, Asian but a decade older than his co-workers, was rapidly folding white cloth napkins into fanciful peak shapes. His hands were as dexterous as those of a magician. All three men wore black shoes, black slacks, white shirts, and black ties. Smiling, the oldest approached Spencer.
"Sorry, sir. We don't open for lunch until 11:30. He had a mellow voice with only a faint accent.
"I'm here to see Louis Lee, if I may," Spencer said.
"Do you have an appointment, sir?"
"No, I'm afraid not."
"Can you please tell me what you wish to discuss with him?"
"A tenant who lives in one of his rental properties."
The man nodded. "May I assume this would be Miss Valerie Keene?" The soft voice, smile, and unfailing politeness combined to project an image of humility, which was like a veil that made it more difficult to see until now that the napkin folder was also quite intelligent and observant.
"Yes," Spencer said. "My name's Spencer Grant. I'm a friend of Valerie's. I'm worried about her." From a pocket of his trousers, the man withdrew an object about the size, but less than the thickness, of a deck of cards. It was hinged at one end. Unfolded, it proved to be the smallest cellular telephone that Spencer had ever seen. Aware of Spencer's interest, the man said,
"Made in Korea."
"Very James Bond."
"Mr. Lee has just begun to import them."
"I thought he was a restaurateur."
"Yes, sir, but he is many things."
The napkin folder pushed a single button, waited while the 7-digit programmed number was transmitted, and then surprised Spencer again by speaking in neither English nor Chinese, but in French, to the person on the other end. Collapsing the phone and tucking it into his pocket, the napkin folder said,
"Mr. Lee will see you, sir. This way, please."
Spencer followed him among the tables to the right rear corner of the front room, through a swinging door with a round window in the center, into clouds of appetizing aromas, garlic, onions, ginger, hot peanut oil, mushroom soup, roasting duck, almond essence. The immense and spotlessly clean kitchen was filled with ovens, cooktops, griddles, huge woks, deep fryers, warming tables, sinks, chopping blocks. Sparkling white ceramic tile and stainless steel dominated. At least a dozen chefs and cooks and assistants dressed in white from head to foot were busy at a variety of culinary tasks. The operation was as organized and precise as the mechanism in an elaborate Swiss clock, with twirling ballerina dolls, marching toy soldiers, prancing wooden horses, reliably tick-tick-ticking along. Spencer trailed his escort through another swinging door into a corridor, past storage rooms and staff restrooms, to an elevator. He expected to go up. In silence, they went down one floor. When the doors opened, the escort motioned for Spencer to exit first. The basement was not dank and dreary. They were in a mahogany-paneled lounge, with handsome teak chairs upholstered in teal fabric. The receptionist at the teak and polished steel desk was a man, Asian, totally bald, 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and a thick neck. He was typing furiously at a computer keyboard. When he turned from the keyboard and smiled, his gray suit jacket stretched tautly across a concealed handgun in a shoulder holster. He said,
"Good morning,"
and Spencer replied in kind.
"Can we go in?" asked the napkin folder.
The bald man nodded.
"Everything's fine."
As the escort led Spencer to an inner door, an electrically operated deadbolt clacked open, triggered by the receptionist. Behind them, the bald man began to type again. His fingers raced across the keys. If he could use a gun as well as he could type, he would be a deadly adversary.
Beyond the lounge, they followed a white corridor with a gray vinyl tile floor. It served windowless offices on both sides. Most of the doors were open, and Spencer saw men and women, many but not all of them Asian, working at desks, filing cabinets, and computers just like office workers in the real world. The door at the end of the hall led into Louis Lee's office, which was another surprise. Tavertine floor, a beautiful Persian carpet, mostly grays, lavender, and greens, tapestry-covered walls, early 19th-century French furniture with elaborate marquetry and ormolu, leather-bound books in cases with glass doors. The large room was warmly but not brightly lighted by Tiffany floor and table lamps, some with stained glass and some with blown glass shades, and Spencer was sure that none was a reproduction.
"Mr. Lee, this is Mr. Grant," said the escort.
The man who came out from behind the ornate desk was 5'7", slender, in his 50s. His thick, jet-black hair had begun to turn gray at the temples. He wore black wingtips, dark blue trousers with suspenders, a white shirt, a bow tie with small red polka dots against a blue background, and horn-rim glasses.
"Welcome, Mr. Grant."
He had a musical accent, as European as it was Chinese. His hand was small, but his grip was firm. "Thank you for seeing me," Spencer said, feeling as disoriented as he might have felt if he had followed Alice's white rabbit into this windowless, Tiffany-illumined hole. Lee's eyes were anthracite black. They fixed Spencer with a stare that penetrated him almost as effectively as a scalpel. The escort and erstwhile napkin folder stood to one side of the door, his hands clasped behind him. He had not grown, but he now seemed as much of a bodyguard as the huge, bald receptionist. Louis Lee invited Spencer to one of the pair of armchairs that faced each other across a low table. A nearby Tiffany floor lamp cast blue, green, and scarlet light. Lee took the chair opposite Spencer and sat very erect. With his spectacles, bow tie, and suspenders, and with the backdrop of books, he might have been a professor of literature in the study of his home near the campus of Yale or another Ivy League university. His manner was reserved but friendly.
"So you are a friend of Miss Keene's? Perhaps you went to high school together. College?"
"Oh, no, sir, I haven't known her that long. I met her where she works. I'm a recent friend. But I do care about her, and, well, I'm concerned that something's happened to her."
"What do you think might have happened to her?"
"I don't know, but I'm sure you're aware of the SWAT team raid on your house last night, the bungalow she was renting from you." Lee was silent for a moment, then,
"Yes, the authorities came to my own home last evening after the raid to ask about her."
"Mr. Lee, those authorities, who were they?"
"Three men. They claim to be with FBI.
"Claimed?"
"They showed me credentials, but they were lying."
Frowning, Spencer said, "How can you be sure of that?"
"In my life, I've had considerable experience of deceit and treachery," Lee said.
He didn't seem either angry or bitter.
"I've developed a good nose for it."
Spencer wondered if that was as much a warning as it was an explanation. Whichever the case, he knew that he was not in the presence of an ordinary businessman. If they weren't actually government agents...
"Oh, I'm sure they were government agents. However, I believe the FBI credentials were simply a convenience."
"Oh, yes, but if they were with another bureau, why not flash their real ID?"
Lee shrugged. "Rogue agents operating without the authority of their bureau, hoping to confiscate a cache of drug profits for their own benefit, would have reason to mislead with false ID."
Spencer knew that such things had happened. "But I can't believe that Valerie is involved with drug peddling."
"I'm sure she isn't. If I'd thought so, I wouldn't have rented to her. Those people are scum. Corrupting children, ruining lives. Besides, although Miss Keene paid her rent in cash, she wasn't rolling in money, and she worked at a full-time job."
"So if these weren't, let's say, rogue Drug Enforcement Administration operatives looking to line their own pockets with cocaine profits, and if they weren't actually with the FBI, who were they?"
Louis Lee shifted slightly in his chair, still sitting erect, but tilting his head in such a way that reflections of the stained-glass Tiffany lamp painted both lenses of his spectacles and obscured his eyes.
Sometimes a government or a bureau within a government becomes frustrated when it has to play by the rules. With oceans of tax money washing around, with bookkeeping systems that would be laughable in any private enterprise, it's easier for some government officials to fund covert organizations to achieve results that can't be achieved through legal means.
Mr. Lee, do you read a lot of espionage novels?
Louis Lee smiled thinly. They're not of interest to me.
Excuse me, sir, but this sounds a little paranoid.
It's only experience speaking.
Well, then your life's been even more interesting than I'd guess from appearances.
Yes, Lee said, but didn't elaborate.
After a pause, with his eyes still hidden by the patterns of reflected color that glimmered in his eyeglasses, he continued,
"The larger a government, the more likely it is to be riddled with such covert organizations. Some small, but some not. We have a very big government, Mr. Grant."
"Yes, but..."
"Direct and indirect taxes require the average citizen to work from January until the middle of July to pay for that government. Then working men and women begin to labor for themselves."
"I've heard that figure, too."
"When government grows so large, it also grows arrogant."
Louis Lee did not seem to be a fanatic. No anger or bitterness strained his voice. In fact, although he chose to surround himself with highly ornamented French furniture, he had a calm air of Zen simplicity and a distinctly Asian resignation to the ways of the world. He seemed more of a pragmatist than a crusader.
"Miss Keene's enemies, Mr. Grant, are my enemies, too."
"And mine."
"However, I don't intend to make a target of myself, as you are doing. Last night, I didn't express my doubts about their credentials when they presented themselves as FBI agents. That would not have been prudent. I was unhelpful, yes, but cooperatively unhelpful, if you know what I mean."
Spencer sighed and slumped in his chair. Leaning forward with his hands on his knees, his intense black eyes becoming visible again as the reflections of the lamp moved off his glasses, Lee said,
"You were the man in her house last night."
Spencer was surprised again.
"How did you know anyone was there?"
"They were asking about a man she might have been living with. Your height, wait. What were you doing there, if I may ask?"
"She was late for work. I was worried about her. I went to her place to see if anything was wrong."
"You work at the Red Door, too?"
"No, I was waiting there for her." That was all he chose to say. The rest was too complicated and embarrassing. "What can you tell me about Valerie that might help me locate her?"
"Nothing, really."
"I only want to help her, Mr. Lee."
"I believe you."
"Well, so then why not cooperate with me? What was on her renter's application? Previous residence, previous jobs, credit references? Anything like that would be helpful."
The businessman leaned back, moving his small hands from his knees to the arms of his chair.
"There was no renter's application."
"With as many properties as you have, sir, I'm sure whoever manages them must use applications."
Louis Lee raised his eyebrows, which was a theatrical expression for such a placid man.
"You've done some research on me. Very good. Well, in Miss Keene's case, there was no application because she was recommended by someone at the Red Door, who's also a tenant of mine."
Spencer thought of the beautiful waitress who appeared to be half Vietnamese and half black. Would that be Rosie?
It would.
She was friends with Valerie?
She is. I met Miss Keene and approved of her. She impressed me as a reliable person. That's all I needed to know about her."
Spencer said, "I've got to speak to Rosie."
"No doubt she'll be working again this evening."
"I need to talk to her before this evening. Partly because of this conversation with you, Mr. Lee, I have the distinct feeling that I'm being hunted and that time may be running out."
"I think that's an accurate assessment."
"Then I'll need her last name, sir, and her address."
Louis Lee was silent for so long that Spencer grew nervous. Finally,
"Mr. Grant, I was born in China. When I was a child, we fled the communists and emigrated to Hanoi, Vietnam, which was then controlled by the French. We lost everything, but that was better than being among the tens of millions liquidated by Chairman Mao.
Although Spencer was unsure what the businessman's personal history might have to do with his own problems, he knew there would be a connection, and that it would soon become apparent. Louis Lee was Chinese, but not inscrutable. Indeed, he was as direct in his way as was any rural New Englander.
Chinese in Vietnam were oppressed. Life was hard. But the French promised to protect us from the communists. They failed. When Vietnam was partitioned in 1954, I was still a young boy. Again we fled to South Vietnam and lost everything.
I see.
No, you begin to perceive, but you don't yet see. Within a year, civil war began. In 1959, my younger sister was killed in the street by sniper fire. 3 years later, 1 week after John Kennedy promised that the United States would ensure our freedom, my father was killed by a terrorist bomb on a Saigon bus.
Lee closed his eyes and folded his hands in his lap. He almost seemed to be meditating rather than remembering. Spencer waited.
By late April 1975, when Saigon fell, I was 30, with 4 children, my wife May. My mother was still alive, and one of my 3 brothers, 2 of his children, 10 of us. After 6 months of terror, my mother, brother, one of my nieces, and one of my sons were dead. I failed to save them. The remaining 6 of us, we joined 32 others in an attempt to escape by sea.
Boat people, Spencer said respectfully, for in his own way he knew what it meant to be cut off from one's past, adrift and afraid, struggling daily to survive.
Eyes still closed, speaking as serenely as if recounting the details of a walk in the country, Lee said,
in bad weather, pirates tried to board our vessel, Viet Cong gunboat, same as pirates. They would have killed the men, raped and killed the women, stolen our meager possessions. 18 of our 38 perished attempting to repel them. One was my son, 10 years old, shot. I could do nothing. The rest of us were saved because the weather grew so bad so quickly. The gunboat withdrew to save itself. The storm separated us from the pirates. 2 people were washed overboard in high waves, leaving 18. When good weather returned, our boat was damaged. No engine or sails, no radio, far out on the South China Sea.
Spencer could no longer bear to look at the placid man, but he was incapable of looking away.
We were adrift 6 days in fierce heat, no fresh water, little food. 1 woman and 4 children died before we crossed the sea lane and were rescued by a U.S. Navy ship. One of the children who died of thirst was my daughter. I couldn't save her. I wasn't able to save anyone. Of the 10 in my family who survived the fall of Saigon, 4 remained to be pulled from that boat. My wife, my remaining daughter, who was then my only child, one of my nieces, and me.
I'm sorry, Spencer said, and those words were so inadequate that he wished he hadn't spoken them.
Louis Lee opened his eyes. 9 other people were rescued from that disintegrating boat more than 20 years ago. As I did, they took American first names, and today all 9 are partners with me in the restaurant, other businesses. I consider them my family also. We are a nation unto ourselves, Mr. Grant. I am an American because I believe in America's ideals. I love this country, its people. I do not love its government. I can't love what I can't trust. And I will never trust a government again, anywhere. That disturbs you?
Yes, it's understandable. But depressing.
As individuals, as families, as neighbors, as members of one community, Lee said, People of all races and political views are usually decent, kind, compassionate. But in large corporations or governments, when great power accumulates in their hands, some become monsters, even with good intentions. I can't be loyal to monsters, but I will be loyal to my family, my neighbors, my community.
Fair enough, I guess.
Rosie, the waitress at the Red Door, was not one of the people on that board with us. Her mother was Vietnamese, however, and her father was an American who died over there. So she is a member of my community.
Spencer had been so mesmerized by Lewis Lee's story that he had forgotten the request that had triggered those grisly recollections. He wanted to talk to Rosie as soon as possible. He needed her last name and address.
Rosie must not be any more involved in this than she is now, Lee said. She's told those phony FBI men that she knows little about Miss Keene, and I don't want you to drag her deeper into this.
I only want to ask her a few questions.
If the wrong people saw you with her and identified you as the man at the house last night, they'd think Rosie was more than just a friend at work to Miss Keene. Though that is, in fact, all she was.
I'll be discreet, Mr. Lee.
Yes, that is the only choice I'm giving you.
A door opened softly, and Spencer turned in his armchair to see the napkin folder, his polite escort from the front door of the restaurant, returning to the room he hadn't heard the man leave.
She remembers him. It's arranged, the escort told Lewis Lee as he approached Spencer and handed him a piece of notepaper.
At 1 o'clock, Lewis Lee said, Rosie will meet you at that address. It's not her apartment, in case her place is being watched.
The swiftness with which a meeting had been arranged without a word between Lee and the other man seemed magical to Spencer.
She will not be followed, Lee said, getting up from his chair. Make sure that you are not followed either.
After rising, Spencer said, Mr. Lee, you and your family...
Yes?
Impressive. Lewis Lee bowed slightly from the waist. Then turning away and walking to his desk, he said,
One more thing, Mr. Grant.
When Lee opened a desk drawer, Spencer had the crazy feeling that this soft-spoken, mild-looking professorial gentleman was going to withdraw a silencer-equipped gun and shoot him dead.
Paranoia was like an injection of amphetamines administered directly to his heart.
Lee came up with what appeared to be a jade medallion on a gold chain.
I sometimes give one of these to people who seem to need it.
Half afraid that the two men would hear his heart thundering, Spencer joined Lee at the desk and accepted the gift. It was 2 inches in diameter. Carved on one side was the head of a dragon. On the other side was an equally stylized pheasant.
This looks too expensive to... It's only soapstone. Pheasants and dragons, Mr. Grant. You need their power. Pheasants and dragons. Prosperity and long life.
Dangling the medallion from its chain, Spencer said, A charm?
Effective, Lee said. Did you see the Kuan Yin when you came in the restaurant?
Excuse me?
The wooden statue by the front door.
Yes, I did. The woman with the gentle face.
A spirit resides in her and prevents enemies from crossing my threshold.
Lee was as solemn as when he'd recounted his escape from Vietnam.
She is especially good at barring envious people, and envy is second only to self-pity as the most dangerous of all emotions.
After a life like yours, you can believe in this?
We must believe in something, Mr. Grant.
They shook hands. Carrying the notepaper and the medallion, Spencer followed the escort out of the room. In the elevator, recalling the brief exchange between the escort and the bald man when they had first entered the reception lounge, Spencer said,
I was scanned for weapons on the way down, wasn't I?
The escort seemed amused by the question, but didn't answer. A minute later at the front door, Spencer paused to study the Kuan Yin. He really thinks she works? Keeps out his enemies?
If he thinks so, Then she must, said the escort. Mr. Lee is a great man.
Spencer looked at him.
You were in the boat? I was only 8. My mother was the woman who died of thirst the day before we were rescued. He says he saved no one. He saved us all, the escort said. And he opened the door.
On the sidewalk in front of the restaurant, half blinded by the harsh sunlight, jarred by the noise of the passing traffic and a jet overhead, Spencer felt as if he had awakened suddenly from a dream, or had just plunged into one. During the entire time he'd been in the restaurant and the rooms beneath it, no one had looked at his scar. He turned and gazed through the glass door of the restaurant. The man whose mother had died of thirst on the South China Sea now stood among the tables again, folding white cloth napkins into fanciful peaked shapes. The print lab, where David Davis and a young male assistant were waiting for Roy Muro, was one of 4 rooms occupied by fingerprint analysis. Image processing computers, high-definition monitors, and more exotic pieces of equipment were provided in generous quantity. Davis was preparing to develop latent fingerprints on the bathroom window that had been carefully removed from the Santa Monica bungalow. It lay on the marble top of a lab bench, the entire frame with the glass intact and the corroded brass piano hinge attached. This one's important, Roy warned as he approached them.
Of course, yes, every case is important, Davis said.
This one's more important and urgent. Roy disliked Davis, not merely because the man had an annoying name, but also because he was exhaustingly enthusiastic. Tall, thin, stork-like, with wiry blonde hair, David Davis never merely walked anywhere, but bustled, scurried, sprinted. Instead of just turning, he always seemed to spin. He never pointed at anything, but thrust a finger at it. To Roy Muro, who avoided extremes of appearance and of public behavior, Davis was embarrassingly theatrical. The assistant, known to Roy only as Wirtz, was a pale creature who wore his lab coat as if it were the hassock of a humble novice in a seminary. When he wasn't rushing off to fetch something for Davis, he orbited his boss with fidgety reverence. He made Roy sick.
The flashlight gave us nothing, David Davis said flamboyantly, whirling one hand to indicate a big zero. Zero! Not even a partial. Crap! A piece of crap, that flashlight. No smooth surface on it. Brushed steel, ribbed steel, checked steel, but no smooth steel.
Too bad, said Roy.
Too bad,
Davis said, eyes widening as if Roy had responded to news of the Pope's assassination with a shrug and a chuckle.
It's as if the damn thing was designed for burglars and thugs. The official mafia flashlight, for God's sake.
Wirtz mumbled an affirmative.
For God's sake.
So let's do the window, Roy said impatiently.
Yes, we have big hopes for the window, Davis said, his head bobbing up and down like that of a parrot listening to reggae music. Lacquer, painted with multiple coats of mustard yellow lacquer to resist the steam from the shower, you see. Smooth.
Davis beamed at the small window that lay on the marble lab bench.
If there's anything on it, we'll fume it up.
The quicker the better, Roy stressed.
In one corner of the room, under a ventilation hood, stood an empty 10-gallon fish tank. Wearing surgical gloves, handling the window by the edges, Wirtz conveyed it to the tank. A smaller object would have been suspended on wires with spring-loaded clips. The window was too heavy and cumbersome for that, so Wirtz stood it in the tank at an angle against one of the glass walls. It just fit. Davis put 3 cotton balls in a petri dish and placed the dish in the bottom of the tank. He used a pipette to transfer a few drops of liquid cyanoacrylate methyl ester to the cotton. With a second pipette, he applied a similar quantity of sodium hydroxide solution. Immediately, a cloud of cyanoacrylate fumes billowed through the fish tank up toward the ventilation hood. Latent prints left by small amounts of skin oils and sweat and dirt were generally invisible to the naked eye until developed with one of several substances, powders, iodine, silver nitrate solution, ninhydrin solution, or cyanoacrylate fumes, which often achieve the best results on non-porous materials like glass, metal, plastic, and hard lacquers. The fumes readily condensed into resin on any surface, but more heavily on the oils of which latent prints were formed. The process could take as little as 30 minutes. If they left the window in the tank more than 60 minutes, so much resin might be deposited that print details would be lost. Davis settled on 40 minutes and left Wirtz to watch over the fuming. Those were 40 cruel minutes for Roy, because David Davis, a techno-geek without equal, insisted on demonstrating some new state-of-the-art lab equipment. With much gesticulating and exclaiming, his eyes as beady and bright as those of a bird, the technician dwelt on every mechanical detail at excruciating length. By the time Wirtz announced that the window was out of the fish tank, Roy was exhausted from being attentive to Davis. Wistfully, he recalled the Bettenfields' bedroom the night before, holding lovely Penelope's hand, listening to the Beatles. He'd been so relaxed. The dead were often better company than the living. Wirtz led them to the photography table on which lay the bathroom window. A Polaroid CU-5 was fixed to a rack over the table, lens downward, to take close-ups of any prints that might be found. The side of the window that was facing up had been on the inside of the bungalow, and the mystery man must have touched it when he escaped. The outside, of course, had been washed with rain. Although a black background would have been ideal, the mustard-yellow lacquer should have been sufficiently dark to contrast with a friction ridge pattern of white cyanoacrylate deposits. A close examination revealed nothing on either the frame or the glass itself. Wirtz switched off the overhead fluorescent panels, leaving the lab dark except for what little daylight leaked around the closed levelor blinds. His pale face seemed vaguely phosphorescent in the murk, like the flesh of a creature that lived in a deep-sea trench.
"A little oblique light will make something pop up," Davis said.
A halogen lamp with a cone-shaped shade and a flexible metal cable for a neck hung on a wall bracket nearby. Davis unhooked it, switched it on, and slowly moved it around the bathroom window, aiming the focused light at severe angles across the frame.
"Nothing," Roy said impatiently. "Let's try the glass," Davis said, angling light from first one direction, then another, studying the pane as he'd study the frame.
"Nothing."
"Magnetic powder," Davis said. "That's the ticket."
Wirtz flicked on the fluorescent lights. He went to a supply cabinet and returned with a jar of magnetic powder and a magnetic applicator called a magnabrush, which Roy had seen used before. Streamers of black powder flowed in rays from the applicator and stuck where there were traces of grease or oil, but loose grains were drawn back by the magnetized brush. The advantage of the magnetized over other fingerprint powders was that it did not leave the suspect surface coated with excess material. Wirtz covered every inch of the frame and pane. No prints.
"Okay, all right, fine, so be it," Davis exclaimed,
rubbing his long-fingered hands together, bobbing his head happily, rising to the challenge.
"Shoot, we're not stumped yet. Damned if we are. This is what makes the job fun."
"If it's easy, it's for assholes,"
Wirtz said with a grin, obviously repeating one of their favorite aphorisms.
"Exactly," Davis said. "Right you are, young Master Wirtz, and we are not just any assholes."
The challenge seemed to have made them dangerously giddy. Roy looked pointedly at his wristwatch. While Wirtz put away the magna brush and jar of powder, David Davis pulled on a pair of latex gloves and carefully transferred the window to an adjoining room that was smaller than the main lab. He stood it in a metal sink and snatched one of two plastic laboratory wash bottles that stood on the counter, with which he washed down the lacquered frame and glass.
"Methanol solution of rhodamine 6G, Davis explained,
as though Roy would know what that was, or as if he might even keep it in his refrigerator at home. Wirtz came in just then and said,
"I used to know a rhodamine. Lived in apartment 6G just across the hall."
"This smell like her?" Davis asked.
"She was more pungent," Wirtz said, and he laughed with Davis.
Nerd humor. Roy found it tedious, not funny. He supposed he should be relieved about that. Trading the first wash bottle for the second, David Davis said,
"Straight methanol washes away excess rhodamine."
"Rhodamine always went to excess, and you couldn't wash her away for weeks," said Wirtz, and they laughed again.
Sometimes Roy hated his job. Wirtz powered up a water-cooled argon ion laser generator that stood along one wall. He fiddled with the controls. Davis carried the window to the laser examination table. Satisfied that the machine was ready, Wirtz distributed laser goggles. Davis switched off the fluorescence. The only light was the pale wedge that came through the door from the adjoining lab. Putting on his goggles, Roy crowded close to the table with the two technicians. Davis switched on the laser. As the eerie beam of light played across the bottom of the window frame, a print appeared almost at once, limed in rhodamine. Strange, luminescent worlds.
"There's the son of a bitch," Davis said.
"Could be anybody's print," Roy said. "We'll see."
Wirtz said,
"That looks like a thumb."
The light moved on. More prints magically glowed around the handle and the latch hasp in the center of the bottom member of the frame. A cluster, some partial, some smeared, some whole and clear.
"If I was a betting man," Davis said, "I'd wager a bundle that the window had been cleaned recently, wiped with a cloth, which gives us a pristine field. I bet all those prints belong to the same person, were laid down at the same time by your man last night. They were harder to detect than usual because there wasn't much oil on his fingertips."
"Yeah, that's right. He'd just been walking in the rain," Wirtz said excitedly.
Davis said, "And maybe he dried his hands on something when he entered the house."
"There aren't any oil glands in the underside of the hand," Wirtz felt obliged to tell Roy. "Fingertips get oily from touching the face, the hair, other parts of the body. Human beings seem to be incessantly touching themselves."
"Hey, now," Davis said in a mock-stern voice, "none of that here, young Master Wirtz."
They both laughed. The goggles pinched the bridge of Roy's nose. They were giving him a headache. Under the lambent light of the laser, another print appeared. Even Mother Teresa on powerful methamphetamines would have been stricken by depression in the company of David Davis and the Wirtz thing. Nevertheless, Roy felt his spirits rise with the appearance of each new luminous print. The mystery man would not be a mystery much longer.
Chapter 7. The day was mild, though not warm enough for sunbathing. At Venice Beach, however, Spencer saw six well-tanned young women in bikinis and two guys in flowered Hawaiian swim trunks, all lying on big towels and soaking up the rays, goose-pimpled but game. Two muscular barefoot men in shorts had set up a volleyball net in the sand. They were playing an energetic game with much leaping, whooping, and grunting. On the paved promenade, a few people glided along on roller skates and rollerblades, some in swimwear and some not. A bearded man wearing jeans and a black T-shirt was flying a red kite with a long tail of red ribbons. Everyone was too old for high school, old enough so that they should have been at work on a Thursday afternoon. Spencer wondered how many were victims of the latest recession and how many were just perpetual adolescents who scammed a living from parents or society. California had long been home to a sizable community of the latter, and with its economic policies had recently created the former in hordes to rival the affluent legions that it had spawned in previous decades. On a grassy area adjacent to the sand, Rosie was sitting on a concrete and redwood bench with her back to the matching picnic table. The feathery shadows of an enormous palm tree caressed her. In white sandals, white slacks, and a purple blouse, she was even more exotic and strikingly beautiful than she had been in the moody deco lighting at the Red Door. The blood of her Vietnamese mother and that of her African-American father were both visible in her features. Yet she didn't call to mind either of the ethnic heritages that she embodied. Instead, she seemed to be the exquisite Eve of a new race, a perfect innocent woman made for a new Eden. The peace of the innocent didn't fill her, however. She looked tense and hostile as she stared out to sea, no less so when she turned and saw Spencer approaching. But then she smiled broadly when she saw Rocky.
"What a cutie."
She leaned forward on the bench and made come-to-me motions with her hands.
"Here, baby. Here, cutie."
Rocky had been happily padding along, tail wagging, taking in the beach scene, but he froze when confronted by the reaching, cooing beauty on the bench. His tail slipped between his legs, fell still. He tensed and prepared to spring away if she moved toward him.
"What's his name?" Rosie asked.
"Rocky. He's shy." Spencer sat down on the other end of the bench.
Come here, Rocky, she coaxed. Come here, you sweet thing.
Rocky cocked his head and studied her warily.
What's wrong, cutie? Don't you want to be cuddled and petted?
Rocky whined. He dropped low on his front paws and wiggled his rear end, though he couldn't bring himself to wag his tail. Indeed, he wanted to be cuddled. He just didn't quite trust her.
The more you come on to him, Spencer advised, the more he'll withdraw. Ignore him, and there's a chance he'll decide you're okay.
When Rosie stopped coaxing and sat up straight again, Rocky was frightened by the sudden movement. He scrambled backward a few feet and studied her more warily than before.
Has he always been this shy?
Rosie asked.
Since I've known him. He's 4 or 5 years old, but I've only had him for 2. Saw one of those little spots the newspaper runs every Friday for the animal shelter. Nobody would adopt him, so they were going to have to put him to sleep.